thanks for the introduction and for inviting me here. It's true, the way to get something reported in the popular press is to have it sound as though it can solve every single problem under the sun, because linear systems of equations are practically the most general problem you ever come across. I'm going to tell you about how quantum computers can solve them and about the limitations of this work and why it can't solve every linear system of equations, but sometimes it does magical things, and other times it's hard to get it to work, like quantum algorithms in general. And like my classical PDF viewing program as well. So I'm going to tell you about this problem you've probably heard of before, solving a linear system of equations. I'm going to talk about how classical computers solve it, and they actually have some pretty good solutions. I'm going to talk about our quantum solution and why it covers some cases that classical algorithms don't do so well at. I'm going to talk a little bit about how the quantum algorithm works, some work we've done on the optimality of the problem, so both talking about why the classical algorithms can't match our performance and why our quantum algorithm can't be substantially improved, and then talking about where to go from here. So the problem, the way, at least in the way I'm going to formulate it, you have a matrix A, which is Hermitian in n by n, and you have a vector B, and you want to find a vector x such that Ax equals b. And I've restricted to square and, in fact, Hermitian matrices, but that's not a big, restriction, because even if A were some general rectangular, perhaps, matrix, definitely not Hermitian, then that matrix is square and Hermitian, and solving the problem for this matrix solves it for, if we solve it for this matrix, then it effectively solves the matrix inversion problem for A. So from now on, we just assume that A is Hermitian. And in some cases of interest, we may not need to actually print out the entire output vector X. For example, suppose we just need some to estimate some features of X, like the average energy or something like this. Or we need to, or we'd like to sample from a probability distribution corresponding to X. These weaker goals are what our algorithm will be able to achieve. And this reflects the fact that if we want to run in sublinear time, then we can't hope to print out the entire string X. So we can only hope to compute some sort of summary statistics of X. And these are the sort of summary statistics that we can achieve.
For any n?
For, we'd like m to be some quantum observable that can be measured efficiently.
So any Hermitian.
Any Hermitian m. Well, and what?
It's exponentially large, so it's only a small set of those that you can make in.
Right. Any Hermitian m, but it's only interesting if it's efficiently computable. Yeah, so let's say any efficiently computable app. So what are classical ways of computing X? The one that you probably first learned was Gaussian elimination, and I'm gonna be nitpicky and say the LU decomposition is slightly faster, but it's the same order of magnitude. A low polynomial in N. So effectively, it's n cubed, this n to the 2.4. No actual algorithm in the world runs that way, but theoretically, we can say it's n to the 2.376.
What is that number?
This number is the matrix multiplication exponent.
I know. Where
do you get it from? Right. So you mean how? So this, if you want to multiply two n by n matrices, doing it naively will take time n cubed. Doing it with a more clever algorithm will give you n to the 2 point something less than that. And the most clever algorithm people have found is n to the 2.376. Now, the way they find these algorithms is with a recursive method. So you can multiply two by two matrices, not with the naive 8 multiplications, but with 7 multiplications and a bunch of additions. Oh, really?
Yeah, because he actually had to multiply matrices. And he got it so time consuming that he wanted to go from 8 to 7.
Remember 2.376 is
like you're walking 7 eighths.
No, that's, you don't get this with...
Then you get a rate, then you get a rate.
Yeah, you don't get this with the with that method. You have to do something. I mean, the if you do the 8... If you do multiply 2 by 2 with 7 multiplications, you get like, I don't know, 2.8 or something. But further tricks along those lines keep this. And the point is, if you have 7 matrix multiplications, if you have 7 multiplications and as many additions as you want, this asymptotically turns into n to the log base 2 of 7. Because the additions don't cost you that much. The additions are sort of order n squared. So that's dominated by the end of the 2.376 order.
Conjectured optimal exponent is 2.
Conjectured, yeah. So it's conjectured that this can be brought down to n squared times poly log n or n to the 2 plus epsilon.
That number is log 7 base 2.
No. This number is better than... So the log 7 base 2 was the first example of beating n cubed. But there have been, you know, this is probably like log 2 of 37 divided by 4, you know, something like this. It represents some fancier way to multiply slightly bigger matrices, but it's in the same spirit. But the key features are some small polynomial dependence on n. In practice, we'd like it to be linear in n. For real algorithms like Google's PageRank, n is the number of web pages, you want things to be linear in n. But the nice thing is that the dependence, this poly log kappa over epsilon. So epsilon here is a desired accuracy, and you get more accuracy just by using more bits of precision. And so they're relatively cheap. Kappa is a measure of how ill-conditioned the matrix is. So we're assuming the matrix is invertible, and so kappa is the product of the norm of A, norm being the largest singular value, and the norm of A inverse. Or if you like, it's the ratio of the largest singular value to the smaller singular value. And you can think about kappa as measuring, you could think of it as measuring how hard it is to invert A. Or another way to say it is how sensitively A inverse depends on changes in A. So if this smallest singular value is very small, then just changing it a little bit will change its inverse by a lot. So it means that you have to use many bits of precision in order to make sure that your round-off errors don't introduce large errors in the output. Fortunately, for algorithms of this type, bits of precision are relatively cheap. So you just pay logarithmically in the accuracy that you want. But this accuracy has to take into it's sort of relative to this condition number. So this condition number starts off as a mild pain, and it will grow into a larger pain as time goes on. So iterative methods are another way of doing this. So solving AX equals B can be thought of as a minimization problem. Find X to minimize AX minus B. Or even better, to minimize, the norm of AX minus B. Even better, minimize the norm squared of AX minus B. This is a quadratic, minimizing a quadratic function, so it's very well behaved. You can use gradient descent, and it'll actually give you a reasonable algorithm. Conjugate gradient is a little bit better. And if you use conjugate gradient, then you find something within epsilon in the minimum in time, in the number of steps proportional to square root of kappa times log 1 over epsilon.
Is that n missing
there? So this is the number of iterations that you need to do. And each iteration, what's cute about this method, each iteration requires basically multiplying your matrix A by a vector, at least a constant number of times. And so so in certain cases, this can be more effective. Now, in the most general case, A has n squared entries. Matrix vector multiplication takes time n squared. So n squared times square root of condition number, not so hot. But if the matrix is sparse, so let's say it's S sparse, meaning the number of non-zero entries per row is at most S, then you can multiply, then the total number of non-zero entries is at most n times s. And multiplying it by a vector takes time n times s. So now the time for the whole algorithm is n s root kappa log 1 over epsilon. Think about, so let's suppose s and kappa are both pretty small, and epsilon, you don't need to be, well, epsilon, this dependence is a logarithm like anyway, so it doesn't matter. Then this is a nearly linear time algorithm to find x. So this is pretty much all you can hope for in the typical classical algorithm, is that the runtime isn't too much worse than reading in the input. And when the conditions, when the stars are aligned, that's what you get with these classical iterative methods. And so the dependence on condition number is exponentially worse than for the Gaussian elimination or the LU decomposition. But this, for many applications, this is a reasonable price to pay if we can get near linear running time. There's one other case of interest, which is not used so often, but is relevant to, but sometimes can be competitive with our quantum algorithm, which is that these iterative methods involve powers of the matrix A. And these powers are basically, you end up applying A root kappa times. So you end up, if your original matrix is S sparse, then your new matrix is at most S to the root k log 1 over epsilon sparse. And if n is really gigantic, then this can mean that you never, that it's more efficient to do this, to incur this exponential cost with kappa rather than actually multiply by the, actually consider the entire matrix, actually consider all n rows of the matrix. So this is just another consequence of these conjugate gradient methods, is that if B is supported on only a few vectors, only a few elements, and if the condition number is not very large, then you can always run in time exponential in the condition number. And it turns out that this running time more or less matches what would happen if you took our quantum algorithm and just did an exponential time simulation on a classical computer. It's sort of competitive with that. So it may not look very good, but in some, but if the parameters are right, it can't be improved upon. Okay, so what about our quantum algorithm? We're going to think of these vectors not as a list of n numbers in memory, but as n amplitudes of a quantum state. Think about the way the quantum Fourier transform is analogous to the classical Fourier transform. It's really performing a kind of incomparable task. It's Fourier transforming the amplitudes. We're going to apply the inverse of a matrix to the amplitudes of a quantum state. So let's suppose our input vector B is a unit vector, and that we suppose it's a vector that we can repair in this amount of time with the quantum circuit. T sub B will be the time to repair it. We're going to assume, make the assumptions of conjugate gradient, that A is an S-sparse matrix. It's efficiently row computable. So this means instead of presenting A as a list of numbers, I'm going to have a circuit which computes the elements of A. I give it an index of a row I, and this circuit spits out all of the non-zero elements of the row as well as where they are. For example, suppose that A is a discretized differential operator. Then it's going to have, let's say, 2s on the diagonal and minus 1s on the off-diagonal. And you don't need to write all that down. You can have a circuit that will spit out what these values are. And that's true even if it's not just, even if you do this on some weird curvy mesh or things like that, then in many cases you can efficiently compute what these things are without having to write down n numbers. And we'll also assume the condition number of A is no more than kappa, and we've rescaled A to fit in this interval. So in this case, we want X to be A inverse times B, except we also want it to be a normalized quantum state. So let's define X prime to be A inverse times B, and X to be the corresponding normalized quantum state.
So in that case that you just said about it being a differential equation. So S would be the degree of the differential equation.
That sounds plausible. Yeah. Yeah, on the order. Yeah, that. Yeah. Okay, so if this is the case, then our algorithm produces the quantum state x as well as an estimate of its norm. That's a classical estimate, up to error epsilon in this amount of time. So condition number times time to prepare b times plus log of n s squared kappa squared over epsilon. So it's so these are the three running times from the previous slide. You've got n to the 2.376, n times root kappa, and then this weird exponential thing. So to compare, let's assume this first term isn't that big, that b is relatively efficient to prepare. Then we get a big improvement in terms of n. We do the same, let's compare to conjugate gradient. We do the same, roughly, slightly worse with respect to s and kappa. And we do exponentially worse with respect to the error epsilon. So the interesting case is when your epsilon is moderately small, but not amazingly small, kappa is pretty small, and the size n is quite large.
Are these two cases the appropriate things to compare in the sense, so in the test algorithm, it gives you a vector.
Yeah.
And here you get the quantum state.
That's right. So you, if you want,
I just wanted to say I put a probability distribution over the classical states x is the over the vector x. Then what is the, wouldn't that be the appropriate running time? Do you know what that is possible?
Yeah, that's a good question. We don't know exactly what the best classical running time is, but we know that you can't improve it too much beyond these modulus and reasonable assumptions. So you're right that this is, as I presented it, not entirely a fair fight. But I'll come back to the fair fight later on. So the problem with this preview thing is that with Keynote, I get to see the next slide. And here, I just sort of see, I'm as surprised as you are. So I forgot. I forgot that my next point was that these runtimes cannot be improved by that much. So in particular, so first the quantum runtime, you know, using these assumptions that we want to sample and blah, 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 you can't substantially improve it. So that 1 over epsilon dependence you may find pretty disgraceful, but you can't improve it to log 1 over epsilon without giving up something else, like this log n. So if you want to change that to log 1 over epsilon, then you have to change this n at least to square root of n, and so on for the other parameters. If you want to match Gaussian elimination and make this log kappa, again, you need to turn this log n into an n. So can't improve the quantum one without, you basically can't improve the quantum one without losing something somewhere else. And the classical algorithms, if they're going to solve the same problem, let's say of, you know, estimating some pretty trivial observable, like sigma z on the first qubit, those classical algorithms can't be sped up by very much either. So, you know, I can't rule out that maybe you could speed this up by a square root or something, but they can't be, you know, you can't turn this n into a log n, subject to some reasonable assumptions.
Let me ask a question. I've never heard of this matrix inversion problem.
Yes, it is. So that's basically where the argument comes from, that the matrix inversion algorithm, as we define it, is BQP hard. In fact, BQP complete. So what we show is that if you have a polytime quantum algorithm, then you can simulate it by solving this type of matrix inversion problem. And so if you think that classical computers can't do that in polytime, then that implies they can't solve the matrix inversion problem in polytime. And if you were to speed this up, That would mean that a quantum computer running for time t could simulate a quantum computation of length t squared, which is probably even more implausible. So that's why this BQP hardness result rules out both of those improvements.
It's BQP hard, not the QMA hard.
It's BQP complete, in fact. But if you fiddle the parameters, then you get other classes.
So are you saying that inverting matrices in some quantum sense is a problem?
For the parameters that we're talking about. So basically, I'm going to talk about this later, but when you take a quantum algorithm and you ask how hard is it to simulate, then the error with which you simulate it turns into epsilon. The number of qubits of your quantum algorithm turns into log n, and the runtime of the quantum algorithm turns into kappa, up to some polynomial factors. So that means that if you were to run in time log 1 over kappa, that means you could run a quantum computation exponentially faster. So,
But it sounds like you have some method for encoding the general quantum computation into a conversion of vectors.
That's right. Yeah, so I'll show that.
Okay.
I'll show that maybe after I show the algorithm.
Can I ask a question which is making up time here because I came in late and I heard Seth talk about this last summer. But my understanding is that you first, in order to get this to work so you don't have kappa being infinity, you have to cast out zeros.
Oh, right. Well, so I've assumed that this matrix doesn't have any eigenvalues less than 1 over kappa, any singular values less than 1 over kappa. Now, I can relax that assumption and instead say, well, I only want to invert it on the subspace corresponding to eigenvectors with eigenvalue greater than or equal to 1 over kappa. So maybe that's what Seth was talking about, or casting out the lower order.
That's exactly what he was casting out. And I guess my question is that if you do that, then in some sense, I would view kappa as going like O of 1 over epsilon.
Well, you're saying that this, because you have error from casting these eigenvalues.
Well, you're making a choice. Yeah, you cast these out and you've got this cutoff.
Right.
And your cutoff is.
Well, it could be better or worse.
It
all depends on the vector B. If B didn't happen to have any eigenvalue, any weight in those eigenvectors, then you haven't made any error from doing the cutoff. If B had all of its weight in those eigenvectors, then you made a huge error. So it's.
A similar thing applies to iterative methods, right? Because they will give you an answer even when there isn't an answer.
That's right.
And when they do, it's like a least squared approximation.
Right. That's true. Yeah, for the iterative methods, you don't know what kappa is. You know, you just have to plug in your upper bound for it. So let me talk briefly about what the algorithm is. The algorithm is pretty simple. The analysis is a little bit finicky, but it's fairly straightforward, at least given things that other people have figured out. Okay, so you have this matrix A, which is Hermitian. We know how to implement e to the iat in running time roughly proportional to t, times some smaller factors, which I'm going to ignore.
Lee.
You said?
Lee. You said Trotter techniques. It's a pet peeve. The formula that people call Trotter's formula was known to Lee.
Ah.
What Trotter did was to generalize it to unbounded operators on Hilbert spaces.
Ah. And what about Suzuki? He gets some credit too, right?
he has another algorithm that's different, and it's a more efficient way of combining things.
But for the higher order, like the higher order one, that's Lieb as well?
Lee.
Lee, Lee algebra Lee.
Yeah, that Lee.
Ah.
It's a very old theorem, and somehow Trotter came along and did the technical stuff that you need to do it for operators
right.
on Hilbert spaces, and now he gets credit for the whole formula.
Well, he has. Trotter has a further advantage that you can Trotterize something, but to Lee-ize is. I don't know, that doesn't work as well. The Lee techniques. Lee techniques.
Well rewarded by names.
Lee Trotter Suzuki techniques.
Their paper used the improvements of Suzuki, which I think are fairly new and very clever.
Yeah, because we want this tilde conceals a weak dependence on epsilon. And if you use the original technique, then your epsilon dependence is a little worse. Okay, so the reason why we want to apply e to the IAT is because that lets us to do phase estimation. And we're going to, actually, I think this is wrong too. I think this was discovered by some people 2 years earlier as well. So if you do this e to the IAT for t ranging in superposition from 0 to t naught, then you can estimate the eigenvalues of A up to additive error 1 over t naught. And so then, if you know the eigenvalues of A, then you can use this to approximately apply this inverse. It also has the nice effect that it breaks up B properly according to the eigenbases of A. And to the extent that it doesn't resolve it exactly, you confuse one eigenvector with another one, you're probably still confusing it with a nearby eigenvalue, so it's not that big a deal. Okay, so what we've done, we've approximately measured the eigenvalue lambda. Lambda is these eigenvalues of A. And now we want to apply A inverse. And that's just that's proportional to a filtering operation. So if you ignore, this is what we want, right? A inverse times B times some constant. That's not unitary, though. So to make it unitary, we complete it into an isometry, which maps B into one tensor, the desired thing, plus zero tensor, some other residual state. And we need this to be unitary, so we need this operator to have norm less than or equal to 1, so we choose C appropriately for that. In fact, we'll actually choose if this is less than or equal to a half to make the analysis easier, but same idea. So we can do this because all of these operators are diagonal in the eigenbases of A. And we've approximately resolved things into the eigenbases of A with phase estimation. And so we just use our estimates of lambda to approximately implement these operators. And then finally, we hope we measure the first qubit, and we hope that the answer is 1. If the answer is 0, then we fail. We have to start over. If it's 1, then we have something proportional to the desired state. And if we count how often we succeed, then we get an estimate of the norm of this state. So that's the basic idea. A few refinements, if you use a slightly more optimal version of phase estimation, things improve. If instead of just repeatedly measuring, you use amplitude amplification, you get another square root savings. But the idea is just this combination of Hamiltonian simulation and phase estimation lets you apply A inverse. In fact, there's something special about A inverse. It'll let you apply any function of A that you like. The errors, of course, are another story. But if you have any function and it depends sort of smoothly on A, then this technique can be used to apply it as a filtering operation.
So what are the two coefficients in
the C, you mean? What do you mean, the two coefficients?
Obviously, I was looking for A inverse group here. I see it there on
right.
The third line from the bottom.
Yep.
What's all the other stuff to the left of it?
So I need to make it unitary.
Doing this coherent way to obviously not be. I guess, could you explain the word can?
Right. So let's see. Is there a way to get board lights?
I think they're over there behind the.
So let's suppose that B is equal to sum over lambda of B sub lambda. So these are the lambda, the eigenvalues of A, and what we want to do is to map it to. So what phase estimation does is it it maps it to sum over lambda. Let's suppose phase estimation were exact. So we just learn, we do phase estimation on this, and we learn lambda exactly. Then we get this extra register lambda here. Later, we can uncompute it and erase this register. But while we have it, we'd like to apply lambda to the minus 1. Now, we can't do that because that's not unitary. And so the first thing we do is lambda to the minus 1 kappa, still not unitary, but at least it's no more than 1, so we're not blowing up the state. But this can be thought of as a filtering operation, where we succeed with some probability. You know, it's like a Krauss element with the eigenvalues between 0 and 1. But what we can do is if we do 1 tensor this plus 0 tensor sum over lambda square root 1 minus lambda minus 2 over kappa squared d lambda. Now this preserves the norm. This is a perfectly respectable unitary operation. Which can be computed by short circuit. Because we only need to know lambda, right? It's just a rotation that depends on lambda.
Well, it can't possibly be a unitary operation because it's mapping a smaller space to a larger space. So it's some kind of partial isometry.
Right. It's an isometry, yeah.
Yes.
You tack on an extra qubit. Then you do this, and then the same process that computed lambda, you can uncompute lambda with, and then you're left with with this thing where I said can. Of course. Yeah.
No, thank you. That was very cool.
Well.
Do I care what your figure of merit is for your phase estimation? Because it can be fidelity.
Yeah, good question. It's in our error analysis, what turned out to matter was the sort of root means, not roots, just the mean square error. And the reason is that if lambda is, if your phase is really far away, then things wrap around, so it can't kill you that badly. So how much time? Oh, I've talked for a long time. So this is how the algorithm works. This is what I was writing on the blackboard, but I forgot that I had on the next slide. but it's more fun to have it on the blackboard. I mean, B, you express in the eigenbasis. Instead of lambda, really you have some estimate, lambda tilde. But lambda tilde is mostly close to lambda. Then you adjoin this extra qubit in this state, uncompute things. It's pretty much what I was just saying. So let's skip this. What about the analysis of the algorithm? Well, the Lee, Trotter, Suzuki, but especially Suzuki, simulation procedure gives you this kind of amazing error scaling of exponential in order square root log 1 of epsilon. But the important thing is that's smaller than any polynomial in epsilon. And we have a 1 over epsilon coming later on. So basically, we'll just say 1 over epsilon is the error dependence. So the dominant term here is going to be this T naught. It's going to be the time for your Hamiltonian simulation. Phase estimation modulo of these subtleties that Vim was asking about gives you error of 1 over T naught. Now, what does this mean? Well, if you get lambda off by 1 over T naught, lambda inverse can be, take the derivative, and that's lambda to the minus 2 over T naught. So as bad as kappa squared over T naught. So looks like we need to take T naught to equal kappa squared over epsilon. There's this scaling factor, which we need to do. So then the post-selection doesn't always succeed, right? We don't always get the outcome 1, but we get it with a probability at least 1 over kappa squared. Post-selection, unfortunately, can magnify the error because a small error on the overall state can be a bigger error on the part we post-select on. So when you first write all this down, you get a runtime of kappa to the fifth, but then you do a lot of algebra, and it comes down to kappa squared. The idea of this is that, you know, there are various worst cases, but the worst cases don't all happen at the same time. So anyway, it's not that interesting, but you can see at various times we're doing efforts sort of polynomial in kappa and polynomial in epsilon. So broadly speaking, our runtime should equal this. We tried for a while to get it below kappa squared because the best runtime, lower bound is root kappa. And we don't know what the runtime what it should be. I mean, it seems reasonable you could reduce it to at least order kappa, but I wasn't able to figure that out. So I want to say a little bit about the, I guess I talked about this earlier in the talk, but I want to talk about the type of solution that's produced by this. So a classical algorithm is just going to output the n values. Our algorithm outputs this this state x, and then using that, there are things that we might want to do. So we could sample the indices I according to this probability distribution, or we could, even weaker than that, is estimate some scalar quantity. Think of M as a diagonal matrix, then you can attain it just by sampling according to this and taking the average that you get from the diagonal entries of M. So these solutions are not strictly, but more or less strongest to weakest. So we get something weaker than classical, but still enough to do these perhaps useful tasks.
Let me ask you, can you sample xi, tensor I? In other words, can you sample the value and its position in the vector?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Good question.
Because it'd be nice to know which entry you had found. That would be interesting.
You mean the amplitude of that entry.
Not just the value of the entry, but...
Yeah. Yeah. So this, the fact that this problem is BQP complete means that whatever task you want to do is as hard as doing the same thing for the output of a general quantum circuit. And so I don't think you can do that for the output of a general quantum circuit.
Well, maybe that'll make more sense when you show us how to translate general circuits into linear algebra.
Yeah.
Sorry, could you say your question?
When he says, when you sample, you get I. But, you know, this thing spits out I with this probability. But you want it to also spit out x of I. Yeah. One way I like to think about this is as analogous to a classical Monte Carlo algorithm, which does similar kinds of sampling. And classical Monte Carlo algorithms have this similar sort of apparently exponential speed up because you have a probability distribution on n objects, but you don't need to write down n numbers. You're only working with log n bits to remember the identity of your object. And you can manipulate it. For example, you want to map from a distribution P to a distribution A times P, where here A is a stochastic sparse matrix. That's just, you know, moving according to a Markov chain. Generally, you can do it efficiently, assuming that things are computable the right way. So you can do sort of matrix multiplication in this model, and sampling you can generally also do efficiently in this model. The difference is that with quantum samples, so this kind of sample, you can also do things like apply inverses. Whereas classically, if you have a sample according to a probability distribution, you can't apply the inverse of a Markov chain in general.
Can I ask another question? Maybe this is too simple, but this seems like if the time is one something nice. So, I mean, basically, you have an algorithm that behaves very nicely with respect to n.
Yeah.
But not so great with respect to kappa and epsilon.
Right.
And that classical algorithms behave terribly with respect to n, but nice with respect to kappa and epsilon.
Yes.
Or better, at least. Now, there are some classical algorithms that, you know, like, that once you get close, zoom right in.
Right.
And have you thought at all about hybridizing this so that, you know, you use the quantum algorithm for the steps when, you know, you're not so worried about it. And then when you start to get, you know, close to the solution when epsilon is getting small, and you know the epsilon's going to kill you for the quantum algorithm, you're close enough that you let the classical algorithm take over and zoom in.
We've tried to think about it and have not succeeded, but I bet there's something there. I think probably the answer will not be a sort of general purpose thing, but you'll have to know more about the structure of the problem. But it does seem that there should be some way of combining it. The reason I say not general purpose is if I ever get to this hardness result, you'll see. Okay, so based on this question, let's see what my next slide is. Okay. Okay, so anyway, these are classical algorithms. Now, you know, I said earlier this wasn't a fair fight. Classical algorithms give you the list of strings. What about this weaker problem? You know, I just want to estimate some observable. Maybe a classical algorithm could do this much weaker task more efficiently, especially because classical algorithms do get exponential speedups for Monte Carlo algorithms. So the reason they can't do this, and I have to say, actually, we found this BQP hardness result because after we came up with the quantum algorithm, we became terrified that, in fact, this was too easy, and surely a classical algorithm should be able to do it also. But the classical algorithms kept on having this sign problem, and then we understood why. Okay, so you have n qubits. Here's a classical quantum algorithm. N qubits, you apply these series of two-qubit gates, U1 through U sub t, and then measure the first qubit. So my claim is that this reduces to a matrix inversion problem. You have to you start off with your vector b just being a 1 in the first entry and 0s everywhere else, so very simple. A, I didn't write down that it's sparse and efficiently row computable, but it is. The sparsity is like 3 sparse, some constant. The matrix M is trivial. It's just 1s for the first half of the diagonal, and minus 1s for the next half of the diagonal. And the dimension of A is like the runtime times 2 to the little n. So basically the dimension of your quantum state space. And kappa goes like t squared. So you can see that if you run our quantum, let's say you take a quantum circuit, encode it in such a matrix, and run our quantum algorithm on it, then our quantum algorithm gives you the answer with only a polynomial over it. This would be a dumb thing to do, but it means that sort of neither our theorem nor our algorithm lose too much. And that means that neither one can be substantially improved without letting a quantum algorithm simulate itself, without giving a general purpose quantum speedup, which seems unlikely.
Sorry, B is the all zeros vector, not just the single zero.
Yes, sorry, it's the all zeros vector. Okay, so as a result, if we had, suppose we had a classical algorithm, which, think about conjugate gradient, which has polynomial dependence on kappa, but if we could improve conjugate gradient, change that n to a polylog n, then, and just constant accuracy, then that would mean that BPP, that's classical randomized algorithms, could do the same thing as BQP, polytime quantum algorithms. So probably unlikely. It also means that if we were to improve our quantum runtime just to a little bit below root kappa, we could get this general purpose quantum speedup. And this doesn't lead to outright contradiction because there's still a matter of how many qubits do you run on. But that would mean that any quantum algorithm operating that uses only n bits of memory can be simulated in time polynomial in n. So p space means you use only n bits of classical or quantum memory, possibly running for exponential time. This sort of general purpose speedup would say any such exponential time algorithm could be reduced to polynomial time. So quite unlikely. Okay, so that's relative. You can say you get these consequences relative to computational complexity assumptions. You can also say, well, if you believe in oracles, let's say that there are we can, or another way to say this is, we can also rule out algorithms that work with respect to oracles, and we can do this unconditionally. So no quantum algorithm for the matrix inversion problem, if it relativizes, can run in this runtime. No classical algorithm, which can accept oracle input, can run in this runtime. And no iterative method, so like conjugate gradient, can beat square root of kappa. So when we first found this, we were pretty excited that we had this quantum solution to an old classical problem, because you know, you see the square root of kappa for conjugate gradient. Wouldn't you like to know if you can improve upon it? And here we have this incredibly convoluted proof using quantum computing. And then Dan Spielman told us that you can also get it by considering the cycle of length square root of kappa. You know, if you consider this cycle, then you need root kappa steps to get around to the end of the cycle. And the condition numbers, and this thing has condition number kappa, so this already is the lower bound for conjugate gradient. But ours is another much more complicated lower bound. you also can't improve the epsilon dependence, or else you'd be able to estimate the acceptance probability of a quantum algorithm to an unreasonable accuracy.
What's the oracle in these cases?
Well, think of the
state and giving the input.
Think of the matrix A as being specified by an oracle,
okay,
like our quantum algorithm does. The oracle is the one where if you give it an index I, it computes tells you all the elements in that row I. So suppose you were to, you know, I were to come in and say, look, I have another algorithm which also accepts the matrix A as an oracle input and has this better runtime, then you would be able to say I was wrong even without using assumptions about complexity theory.
So Spielman's argument is that, well, you know, just take an adjacency matrix over a kind of random graph and kind of figure out how to kind of like walk around and apply it over and over again.
So if you take an iterative methods that use t steps, basically you work with the powers of, you're basically using the span of identity a squared dot 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 a to the t, and so he says that in this, basically, if t is less than the length of the cycle, you can't distinguish a cycle from, you know, you can't tell how long the cycle is before you've gone around the end. Okay, so finally, what is this proof of BQP hardness? I'm going to tell you an almost correct idea, which is close enough to correct that it doesn't matter. So what's our quantum circuit? We apply these gates, UT through U1. And the space is going to be the usual kind of hardness thing where you have space for n qubits and you have a clock register of t dimensions. And you have this, I think it's called the Feynman or Kataev unitary, but maybe even Dirac came up with it. You have this unitary due to myself and my co-authors, which, what does it do? It advances the clock by one modulo t, so it's unitary, and then applies the next step of the circuit. Now, I'm going to define this matrix A, the one we're going to invert, is going to be identity minus V times e to the minus 1 over t. So the largest largest eigenvalue of this thing is at most 2, and the smallest eigenvalue is at least 1 over t. Think of e to the minus 1 over t as 1 minus 1 over t. So we're 1 minus 1 minus 1 over t gives smallest eigenvalue of t. So I guess that should be 2t. Kappa should be no more than 2t. And now, what's A inverse? Well, A inverse is you just use the formula 1 over 1 minus x equals 1 plus x squared and so on. A inverse is the sum over all k of e to the minus k over t v to the k. Now, think about this as applying a superposition of v to the k for different values of k, where k is sort of geometrically distributed with mean of t. And so there's a good chance that you'll apply it for, so if the mean is t, then you'll probably apply it for on the order of t time steps. And so you'll probably apply something kind of like the quantum circuit you want to apply. So in particular, if you do A inverse times psi with starting the clock register in the state 1, then you'll have some non-negligible overlap with V to the T times that, which corresponds precisely to your desired quantum circuit. Now, this doesn't quite work because you wrap around and you introduce errors when you wrap around. These things, when you analyze it, it's not quite so nice, but it's very easy to fix up this wraparound. What you do is you simply have the first t time steps be your circuit, the second t time steps are do nothing, and the final t time steps are invert your circuit. So now, even if you wrap around, you don't introduce any new errors. If you apply this thing for 3t time steps, you've just come back to where you started. So wrapping around further just gives you more weight of exactly the correct answer. So now V is a sum over these 3t time steps. A is the same story. And now if you apply this, you have a constant amount of overlap with things that correspond to successful computations. So if you apply, so you think of this as applying sort of a random number of time steps, especially if you measure the first register, then what you obtain is a computation where a random number of time steps have happened. And if the number of time steps is anywhere between t plus 1 and 2t, then your desired quantum circuit has been applied. And this happens with at least constant probability.
I mean, the idea is just that you make the circuit do a lot of nothing.
That's right.
Sample random times.
Right.
Most likely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's just a technical detail. I mean, the intuition comes from the fact that if that matrix inversion looks like applying this thing to a high power. In fact, you can even think of it, one way to think about the inverse of a matrix as being sort of like a variable degree polynomial, where the degree of the polynomial is kind of like the condition number. So you're raising things, you're raising this, when you do this expansion, things are going to die out according to the condition number. And so it's always going to, I mean, matrix inversion kind of always looks like this geometrically distributed thing. Okay, so.
Can you remind me why we're converting only this very special form of it?
Because I want to show that if you can invert this special A, then you can simulate the output of a quantum computation. And so, measuring, if you can simulate this and then measure the output state, even doing some very simple measurement, then you've simulated the answer to a quantum computation.
And what was the relation between V and U?
So V, U is your quantum circuit.
Oh, and then V is the clock version.
And V encodes it into this thing with the clock. So A depends, pretty simply on your basic circuit U. So you can think of A as being implemented by, A is an efficiently row computable matrix, sparse and so on. So with this thing, that implies that classical algorithms can't do what we do. That implies that our quantum algorithm can't be substantially improved unless you move the goalposts, which is often a good way of solving problems. There's some related work. This paper, given a unitary, will simulate other powers of the unitary using a similar kind of phase estimation trick. These guys have built upon our work to something for differential equations. Hamiltonian simulation is also used in this paper. And a similar BQP completeness result is in this last one. I want to say I'm over time, but let me just say briefly that in the case when A does have very small eigenvalues, you're not totally doomed. You can choose kappa to be an estimate, basically a measure of where you want to solve the problem. So you say, well, I only want to invert the matrix where the eigenvalues are at least 1 over kappa, and I don't care what happens to the rest. So then you can do this in time proportional to kappa squared, and the algorithm will even be polite enough to give you a flag saying when you've input something with eigenvalues that are too small, and that it's failed. It's not perfect because you can't determine a precise threshold, so what you have to say is, well, for eigenvalues above 1 over kappa, we work. For eigenvalues below 1 over 2 kappa, we definitely give you the flag. In between, no promises. One frustrating open problem is that if the norm of the matrix is much larger than 1, we'd like to be able to sort of rescale almost dynamically in a way where we do it based on how much of the vector B lies in the large eigenspaces of A. The difficulty here is that these methods for doing e to the iat, we don't know how to do them efficiently when you restrict the low energy subspace of A. So given this, the problem we have is if you have a Hamiltonian with perhaps very largest eigenvalue, but we're applying it to a state that lives on the low energy subspace, we want to simulate the Hamiltonian in time proportional just to, you know, the energy of this low energy subspace. We don't know how to do that, and we don't know any reason why it should be impossible. So it's frustrating, but an interesting problem. And perhaps
you have the nagging feeling that maybe there's a reason why you cannot do it. Like you say, we should.
Right. Well, Andrew Childs has some evidence that this is sometimes that, you know, a very strong. So the conjecture is that you can simulate in time proportional to the low energy of the low energy subspace. This sort of strong version of that conjecture, Andrew Childs has a counterexample to. But for sparse matrices, it's still possible. Another thing we'd like to do is apply, well, let me just say, I'll tell you about this afterwards if you're interested. Preconditioners are a good classical method for dealing with high condition number, and seems they ought to be applicable quantumly. That's something that remains to be worked out. And of course, this is a sort of general purpose tool, but be nice to apply it to very specific examples. For example, there are nice preconditioners for elliptical PDEs, classically. So working out exactly how, if that applies to quantum algorithms, if it works out, would be a nice thing. Getting a polytime speed up to linear programming, things like this are things which would be interesting to see if this thing could work for. That's all. Thanks for your attention.
I'm sure you'll get down to x.
Yeah.
But you really just want to determine all your x's in size.
Yeah.
How many measurements?
Well, you need. You. It depends what accuracy you want, but you're going to need at least n. So if you really want to output the whole vector x, you probably want to do something classical. Because if the condition number was low, then you could have run conjugate gradient and output the whole vector x. So yeah, this is only interesting in cases when you don't want nearly the whole vector x. On the other hand, you can get, you know, you can apply further quantum algorithms. So if you want to, what are the large Fourier coefficients of x, you know, then you can still do things like that.
Yeah. In your slide on related work, I didn't see Abrams listed. A couple years ago, he and co-authors a paper about solving linear PDEs.
Cool.
Oh, we don't know this, I was going to ask you for a comment.
I should check it out.
Okay.
Is it, so this one by Layton and Osborne is scaled very well with the number of variables and poorly with the time that you integrated over. I don't know, is this Abrams' work? Does it get similar performance to that? Do you remember?
Well, first place, it was linear PDEs. Should be easier, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't remember. I don't remember the estimates.
Okay, no, I'll look it up.
So if I assume that quantum computation is exponentially faster in general,
yeah.
Then what's the bound for the peak? What's the bound that you get for sampling text and sampling expectation in the classical?
I don't remember. It's not actually linear in n. I think it's like square root of n. I think it says a classical algorithm can't beat square root of n, or cube root of n. It's something like that. I thought there were enough equations in the slide, so I didn't put it up there. The lower bound,
relative to Oracle's stuff.
Relative to Oracle's is about the same, because Simon's algorithm is as close as you can get to Simon's algorithm. You can do quantumly in time order n, and classically takes time, 2 to the order n. So you get that kind of separation for Simon's algorithm. And so that's what we use to construct this this classical lower bound relative to Oracle's.
Okay, but I thought from before you can get a lower bound which is not relativized.
Oh, yeah, right.
This is what I meant.
Actually, I'm pretty sure it's square root of n, because the... I shouldn't just make up things while I'm being recorded. Let's talk about it afterwards.
Can you do it like a Monte Carlo type thing, where you sort of can think of axiom X being some path of multiplications?
Right.
And you add up enough of those and you get some estimate of X and X. I mean, is that how it works, or is it done in some other much cleverer way?
The best classical algorithm, you mean?
Yes, the best classical algorithm.
The problem with doing that is you have these alternating signs, which make it hard to get control of the errors. So I think the best classical algorithm, even for sampling that I know, is still just conjugate gradient. But there may be some better ones out there. Yeah, I should probably we did look into that a little bit. I don't know how often this is even considered classical.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.